Batson, real 14. Now, you got to the point, you just offered the bayonet to try and swap for these boots.
Yeah, and it was a foreigner. I don't know what nationality he was, but it was a foreigner. And what with my German and his German, he must have misunderstood the fact that I wanted to use this bayonet as part of the bargaining power for a pair of boots. And they were real German Alpine boots. There was cleats all round the edges and the soles, all these big studded things. And the tops was, where it fitted round the ankle, was green velvet, like a velvet, so that it wouldn't make your ankle sore. And there was a really good pair of boots. Anyway, when he saw me draw this bayonet out, he thought I was going to stab him with it or something, and he took a pair of these boots from round his neck and grabbed two or three packets of cigarettes and made off up the road as quick as he could go. And he got a mate with him, but they both went off together. And I thought, well, that's handy. For the sake of two or three packets of fags, I've got this pair of boots. And I took my old ones off and put the new ones on straight away, and they fitted just like a glove, as if I'd been measured for them. Really good.
Now, you went down to the village, and they were looting some wine, I think.
Yeah, it's these great big wine containers. And they was oval in shape, they weren't round, but they stood, I should say, to guess, 10 foot high, or something similar, and oval in shape, happened a good 10 foot long, and I can't really give you the exact how many gallons it'd be in, there's about three of these all together, one side of the other in this place, and they'd already been got at by the lads, and there was people laid with their mouths under the holes that they'd made in the barrel, and it was absolutely out of their minds, you know, just laid there laying this wine run into the gullets. But it wasn't a nice tasting wine. It wasn't mature. It was a rough red wine. And I got a cup and tried. There'd been holes made in these barrels and taps running, and the place was flooded all over the place. And I didn't like this wine, so I thought, well, I'm not going to bother with that. And I moved on from there, and we went into, I think it was called Landschutz, the town, the nearest town to the camp. And there's a lad there amongst our gang, and he'd been taken prisoner in Norway. Sid Barthorpe, his name was. And he's a bit of a mechanic, and we went in garages to try and anywhere we saw a car, we went and tried to get it going, and we didn't have no success, so we just moved on. And Sid stopped in one garage and fiddled about, and we'd happened been gone quarter of an hour in front of him going through Landschutz, and tootling on the horn, and turned around, and there was Sid Barthorpe with his car. He'd managed to get one of them going and got some petrol in it, and we went on a tour around the town in this car. And he'd made a good job, because we couldn't manage to get one going anyway, but we had this car for about a day. I don't know how we come to lose it, whether we left it parked somewhere and somebody else pinched it or what, but it vanished, so we hadn't got a car to move about in. And Americans organisers tried to keep us in the camp, and we just watched the words. And they tried to keep us in the camp, and we, when any of the soldiers come in to see the mates or try and find mates of theirs, the Americans, we used to dive in the back of the car, the lorries or jeeps or whatever they were, and get out that way and put some American jacket on or whatever, and if there were any guns kicking about, we'd put one of them across his knees just as if we were part of the lorry, and we'd get out of the camp that way and have a good tour around. Well,
were you warned not to eat too much early on? Because you know if you eat too much...
No, it was a case of not eating too much. It was a case of getting enough to eat. And this is how we used to go out all round the camp area and go to outlying farms to see if we could find any extra rations. No, nobody warned us about eating too much, but once the Yanks had got there, it was really nice because they'd tons of snap, and the ordinary white loaf which you used to bake on the site, they carried their own baking ovens in these regiments and that, and we thought it was cake. We couldn't believe, because we'd been eating black bread for that long, we couldn't believe that this bread was bread. We thought it was cake. And we got used to it after time. But the K rations, as they call them, they had different ones for different things, and they were all pretty good. One of these K ration packs for the day had cigarettes and chocolate and various kinds of food that you could eat on the move, and they were quite good, and we had plenty of them.
So how long was it before you left? Because you didn't leave officially, did you? You made your own way to Japan.
They told us as near as they could. They said these Dakotas were the ones that they were using for transport, the Dakota aircraft, and they said that when they brought things over, ammunition and anything that was required, then when they was empty, instead of flying back out to where they loaded up, they'd take so many prisoners. And there was that many people in the camp, they said they're going to draw numbers, and the wounded would be taken first, and then the others after. And they had a general draw, hut by hut. And it appears we'd drawn about number 32, and after 3 or 4 days, there'd only been one plane load, or possibly two, I don't know. And we thought, well, if at this rate, we're going to be here for another couple of months. So we decided to hitchhike it. And about four of us got together and set off. Sid Barthorpe was one of them, and Horace Jarvis, a Navy man from Ilkeston, who was taken prisoner at Crete. He was on a small boat trying to guard Crete against the German paratroops, but he wasn't successful, and he got taken prisoner. And he was another one of the gang, and there was about four or five of us. And as regards getting a lift, we could always stop any American lorry on the road and he'd give us a lift if it was going in the right direction. And they were pretty good. Most of these transport drivers was darkies from America. They used to drive like elves, just as if the devil was after him, and if he had been, he wouldn't have caught him because he used to drive that fast. And we managed to get, as we got off one lorry, they'd tell us where the next one was going, or point us in the right direction and we'd get a lift of air. And after so many hits and misses, we stopped at the side of the River Rhine in a big wine distillery, wine place, a German wine place. Louise Gunther was the name of the firm, and they used to make some really fine wine, all kinds. And it was like a big castle, one part of it, a really posh place. And the cellars, there was acres and acres of cellars all stacked up with wine. And the first thing we did when we got through the door, the Americans were using it for a transport depot. And first thing when we got through the door, they said, line up here and you'll get something to eat. And as we went through in this line, they put a slice of bread on his hand, and then a whole chicken, and then another slice of bread on top, and a bottle of wine. And that was for each man as he went through. And that wasn't preferential treatment for us. It was what the Americans were getting as they were coming back from driving. And they took us a tour around the cellars, and the American officer said, when the war's finally finished, we're going to let the lads have what they want, but at the moment it's under bond and they can only have one bottle of wine per day per man. So I wasn't there when it was liberated, actually, when that part. Well, I was there, it was liberated, but I wasn't there when war in Europe were finished. And it was really good. And the bridge that was supposed to cross the Rhine at that particular point had been blown up, and there was a village over the other side, and alongside the River Rhine was a table, and American guard sat with all various different kinds of guns. The table was filled with all different kinds of ammunition, and he was supposed to be on guard there. Anything that come floating down the river, down the Rhine, a lot of Germans were escaping that way and floating down on anything and getting away. So they got to shoot at everything that was coming by, and we thought we'd have a go at that, and we did do. We got various guns, all different kinds of guns. Some had proper American Army issue, and others were German guns that had been captured.
Were you actually shooting at Germans, or just at...
Shooting at anything that floated down the river, because there might have been a German hiding inside it. You know, anything that floated by, you'd got to shoot at it. And that's what we did. But in the meantime, when there was nothing come floating by, we'd shoot at these remains of the bridge over the other side of the River Rhine, and it was right against the side of a village. And as we were shooting at these things, we could hear the bullets ricocheting off the metalwork and anything that was in the way of its path. And after about half an hour, an American officer came up and said, you'll have to stop shooting. You're injuring German villagers that are walking about in the village. We'd already winged somebody in the arm. We didn't know that these bullets were hitting them, but that put paid to that game. We couldn't carry on firing anymore. So that was it. We were there to happen 2 days in this place. I can't remember, really.
Didn't matter much. Then but what?
Then we moved on and hitchhiked again, and we got into a village, and everybody was congregating round this particular farmyard and said, what's going on? And they said, well, war's finished or near enough, and they're having a celebration. So the American that was with us, he was a white American, actually, which was strange on the transport, because they were mostly darkies. And he wasn't long in getting changed into his Sunday best suit, which he carried with him. And, of course, we did our best to look a bit better than we were normally. And I'd still got these German boots on. I kept them on for months. And it was a celebration thing, because they knew that the Germans had near enough packed in. And so they were having a big party. And we got into this where they were dancing. And the American picked up the prettiest girl he could see, and she happened to be the village queen. And one of the Frenchmen that was in the army, he was all done up like a dog's dinner, and he thought he was the cat's whiskers. But when this young lady got with the American, she didn't want no to do with the Frenchman, even though she was French herself. And this Frenchman started being funny, and so they said they were going to, the American and the Frenchman were going to fight it out, and they thought it was fisticuffs, but it wasn't. The Frenchman pulled a knife out, and they managed to get that off him and said, "No, you fight with fists, or not at all." And there were that many people kicking about, this Frenchman managed to get off out of the way. When he knew it was going to be a fist fight, he didn't want to know. And he vanished, and the American began to lose interest in the place, and so we said we'll move on. And we moved on to on the outskirts of Paris, actually. I don't know how many hours we were travelling before we got there. And as we got into Paris, that was when VE Day was declared. So they took us into a big place called Magazines d'Orfeo, which was a kind of Selfridges. It was a big general store for clothing. And it was a really big store. And the Americans had taken it over, and there was beds and lockers and everything. And apart from issuing, it was a leave centre where people, American soldiers coming on leave, used to clock in there, get the food and everything, and then go on a general tour around Paris. And as prisoners, we were taken in there, and a major interrogated us. Well, we'd lost Sid Barthorpe somewhere along the way. And there was me and this Scotchman who had been a prisoner in southern France, the unoccupied part of France, until the Germans decided to take over unoccupied France as well. And he finished up in our camp. And he'd spent quite a lot of time in France, and he could speak really good French. And I managed to finish up with him in this place. And
at the leave centre, you mean?
Yeah, and there was all these lockers and beds where you could go and sleep when you wanted. And in these lockers, as different people were coming in from all over the place, they were leaving food in these lockers, tins of corned beef and salmon and any kind of tin food. And these lockers, some of them were a matter of 100 weight of them and food inside them. And one of the old Frenchmen that was paid to clean up in there, we said, "Why don't you take some of it?" And he valued his job that much. He said, "No, he weren't going to have any." So we said, "Right, well, we'll have some." And we filled a couple of sacks or something like that and went out to do trading with the estaminet people. They weren't long at finding one of them, and they looked grubby, some of these places did, But upstairs, where the owners lived, it was just like a palace, you know. And once we'd got through the door, with this saying we wanted to change some of this tin food for money or whatever they'd got, so they invited us upstairs. And while Adam was talking business with them, out was a bottle of brandy and kept filling his glasses up, and I couldn't speak French, so I just sat there supping this brandy. And by the time Adam had done selling all this food that we'd got a fistful of notes, and I was about drunk, but we managed to stagger out of there. And so we said, well, this is a good idea, we'll have some more tomorrow. And we paid to go round different places, the Eiffel Tower and all that, and where the Hunchback of Notre Dame, we had a look round there. And most of the French people were after money as well as we were, but they were more so after food. And this place we were billeted, there was an office there, and the side of it was a big notice board, and they told us that if your name appears on this board, you report here straight away, you get a ticket, and they ship you off to the coast to get a ferry over to England. And you've got to come as soon as you saw your notice, your name on this board. Well, we came by after 2 days, and we saw a name there, and we rubbed it off. And after the next time we saw it, it said, Battison and Menzies, if you do not report to the... They knew that we must have rubbed it off, although they didn't actually see us. If you don't report back to the office as soon as you see this notice, you're going to be put on a charge, more or less. What do they call it?
AWOL.
Absent without leave, yeah. And you'd be shipped back to England under guard. So we decided we'd had a good run. And actually, on the first night, on the Victory in Europe Day, we went to this place called the Rainbow Club. It was where American servicemen met for dancers and things like that. And they'd got three bands. Being it was VE Day, Victory in Europe, they'd got three bands, and as fast as one band finished his session, this other one had step up. And Glenn Miller's band was one of them, although he was missing. They never found out what happened to him, and he was dancing to his band. Well, I'd got these German Alpine boots on, I'd got a brand new American Army uniform that they issued us with, I'd got everything except an overcoat. I'd got a complete issue of clothing, and that all American, and they'd got no boots to fit me. They'd run out of them. So I had to keep these German Alpine boots on. And we went in this big posh place for dancing. You just got to show them this pass that you were an ex-prisoner of war and you could get in anywhere. And same for food. There were food places all over Paris. You could go in any one of them and eat your fill. And so I stood there watching them dancing for so long, and them thought, well, we've had enough of this. And we got a woman apiece to dance with, and we're dancing around the floor. Well, there wasn't so much dancing as just moving around. And every time I put my foot out on this floor, it was a lovely, highly polished floor. And I'm making scratch marks all over it. And so I'd gone about halfway round, couple of these snowdrops, as we call them, the American police, military police with a white helmet. That's why we call them snowdrops, because of the white helmet. And they come and grab me and said, come on, you can't go. But what are you doing to the floor? Don't come dancing here again. We'll sit and watch you or do whatever you want. So waited until he'd gone out of sight again and decided to have another go. And because it wasn't long before they come and pick me up, grab me one each side of me. They must have been about 6'3" apiece. And they picked me up bodily, carried me off the floor, straight to the front door, and threw me out onto the road. And don't come back. That was a message. And I didn't dare risk it after that. But I seemed to lose Adam for the rest of that night. We turned up the next day in the billets. And, of course, we filled another sack full of food and went out trading again. And it was the same thing. It didn't matter which one of these cafes you went to. They were quite willing to trade you either money or something for the tinned food.
Now, you got to the point before where you were just going to go back. Your names had appeared and you were going to be charged with AWOL. How did you get back to England?
That was it. We reported. Adam said to me, he said, well, we've had a good run now, we might as well go back. And so that's where we went and reported, and they gave us a ticket and shipped us off. And we finished up, I think it was Dieppe, but I'm not quite certain about that even. I should be, really.
Doesn't matter.
I think it was Dieppe. And then put you on the boat and across to England, and at the other side there was all kinds of military police hanging about, and you'd got to report to them, or they'd come and pick you out, especially there's people trying to nip away from France and Germany and that. And they picked me up and said, where are you going? I said, I've been told to report to Chatham because that's my barracks. I'd never been there in my life. But that was where I was. My number was CJX, which meant I was a Chatham rating. And so they put me on the boat, on the train, and down to Chatham barracks I went. Gets to the main gate, and there's a sailor on duty there with his fixed bayonet, and stood there. And I said, I was in a complete American uniform, and I said, I've been told to report to you. This is my barracks. And he says, up it, go on. Because they had all kinds of people kidding them on and doing, and he thought I was a Yank trying to get into the naval barracks. And I said, now look, I've been told to report to you, you better let me in. I'm an ex-prisoner of war, and I should report to you to get sorted out. And he said, you know, F off. Yes, I'm going to ram this up your behind. And I said, well, if you won't let me in, I'm going up to the station, I'm going to catch a train and go back to England. I said, and you'll be in trouble then, not me. Well, it appears that an officer was at the other side of the partition, again the main gate, and he'd heard all this conversation going on. So I got about 20 or 30 yards up the road, and they shouted me back. And I went back, and they explained to him what had happened like, and he said, oh, you better come in then. And he said, where were you taken prisoner and all this kind of business? And as soon as I mentioned centre there, he said, oh, you're one of them, are you? He said, that was a pretty rough job, you know. He had a bit of a conversation with me. He says, you were to come in, and it must have been about 5 or 6 o'clock at night, I can't really tell, but it had, the barracks had more or less closed down for the weekend, especially as victory in Europe had just been declared. And he said, "You'll be wanting to get home on leave then." I said, "I hope so." He said, "Well," he was a duty officer, and he could get anybody he wanted, doctors, writers, and everything, people that make the railway warrants out and the lot. And he said, "I'll go and get them all out." And he got doctors that were supposed to be going on leave and all that kind of thing, and he got them all lined up. And I went through the lot, and I was what they call doing the routine barracks. When you come fresh into barracks, it takes you about 3 days normally, and I was in there, got a uniform,